Lecture 11, The Early Dynastic Period.
Although the Gilgamesh epic is mythical, it does give us a glimpse of what the Mesopotamians believed their early cities and leaders were like. Let's move now back to the world of mortals. When we last examined southern Mesopotamia in the late Uruk period, we saw the rise of cities, and remember that they are extensive, filled with people who practice different professions. This is the place where writing developed, where a large bureaucracy and thriving economy was recorded in the new texts that were created. The idea of the city moved quickly, probably up the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. By 2800 BC, we see a string of cities from the south, set up next to each other, reaching to central Mesopotamia. The late Uruk period dates to around 3000 BC, so in that 200-year period between the late Uruk era and the early dynastic period, we see there is a wide expansion of the concept of urbanization. Each city was likely self-sustaining as far as food production. Trade and exchange was for other commodities that would go back and forth between the different cities. In this lecture, we will examine contemporary historical texts for the first time, and we'll move away from economic texts just for a little bit. They'll come back. And we will see the political structures and rulers develop in the cities and examine their relationship with areas and regions outside of Mesopotamia. In the early dynastic period, which lasts from about 2900 BC to 2350, contemporary texts help to inform us about the political and economic organization of the region. We haven't really seen this type of evidence up to this point. Until the third millennium, written sources recorded mainly economic and administrative transactions, noting various goods that were exchanged or perhaps counted. But beginning around 2500 BC, historical events, especially the deeds of rulers, are memorialized in writing. These earliest contemporary texts consist of short royal inscriptions that mark the dedication of offerings by a ruler. Through these, we see from the very beginning that the interaction between the ruler and the gods is essential. The first named ruler is Mebagarezi of Kish, who ruled around 2700 BC. There are two inscriptions with his name and position listed. A variant of this type of inscription on offerings describes a king contributing to or overseeing a building project, such as a temple, which was the most common project that a king would sponsor. The inscriptions are usually brief, including the name of the ruler, the deity, and the name of a building, if it had a name, as temples often did. These references help us create the framework for the political history of the region. And the inscriptions also confirm the responsibility of a ruler as someone who makes offerings to the gods and who oversees public building projects. A new type of inscription appears around the end of the early dynastic period and focuses on the military success of a ruler. This is the first time that military expeditions are recorded in texts, and scholars have proposed from this new type of evidence that leaders began to be chosen for their skill in war, rather than as administrators or as an intermediary with the gods. This is a somewhat dangerous argument from silence in that just because we have not had any references to rulers being involved in military expeditions, doesn't mean that it didn't happen. Studying ancient history requires that we consider both the evidence that we do have and the problems with it, as well as trying to think about what is missing and why that might be. I think we should take this idea of a major shift in responsibility of the ruler somewhat cautiously, because this is an example of an argument from silence.